Fish and Wildlife Service believes the ivory-billed woodpecker is extinct, but not everyone is so sure. NBC 10's Sydney Lane spoke with one man whose mission and research is to prove the bird is still lurking in the vast swampland of Louisiana.
And then this bird just burst across in front of us at close range, about 65 feet away. And it was just, I mean, I dropped my paddle and almost fell out of the canoe. I mean, it was like...
The news made headlines around the world.
Nang mamataan niya sa Cache River sa Arkansas ang ivory-billed woodpecker.
I cannot think of a single time we have ever found a species once thought extinct and now found to be in existence.
It was announced a couple of days ago that Neil Waters has found, apparently, or taken a photograph of a family of thylacine.
More than 80 years have passed since the last Tasmanian tiger died in captivity, but that hasn't stopped a steady stream of reported sightings.
And it stood and glared at me, and I could see these big black featureless eyes searching my face. It just stared, give me an eyeball me. And then I seen the stripes, and I nearly fainted. I went into shock. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Actually, he was an animal I've been searching for so long.
Well, this is a peaceful spot.
It is, and it's astonishing to be surrounded by so much long grass, gravestones, and ancient trees.
Yeah, we're in the New Forest, and we are sitting in front of the grave of Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of all of those great Sherlock Holmes stories and other things, and of course also. People sometimes forget he was a great champion of the esoteric, the Cottingley fairies. He was a big champion of, had a firm belief in the afterlife and those things.
I made a firm commitment to contact people after he died, interestingly enough, and almost certainly didn't happen.
Indeed, and on the 13th of July 1930, 5 days after Conan Doyle's death, a huge crowd of more than 10,000 gathered at London's Royal Albert Hall, gathered to witness the spiritualist medium Estelle Roberts conjure Conan Doyle's spirit. Along with Roberts, Lady Conan Doyle took to the stage alongside members of his family, with a vacant chair on her right reserved for her late husband. It was all, of course, a carefully choreographed event. Such was Conan Doyle's belief in the afterlife, and such was his commitment to his spiritualist beliefs, that he firmly believed he would return in spirit form. He did not appear. Although Estelle Roberts asserted that she'd seen Conan Doyle sitting in the empty chair, she claimed to have conveyed a message from Sir Arthur, though apparently only his wife heard it. It was evidently unheard by everyone else due to a burst of dramatic chords from an enthusiastic organist at the Albert Hall that day. Why are we so often reluctant to let go of that which is demonstrably gone? We live in the age of the sixth mass extinction. Excluding the hundreds of thousands of plant and insect species that are disappearing, perhaps even before we find them, at least 500 species of land animal are expected to become extinct in the next 20 years. The same amount that was lost in the entirety of the 20th century. 77 of those 500 have lost 94% of their historic population. Extinction breeds extinctions, the scientists who led one study said. When humanity exterminates other creatures, It is soaring off the limb on which it is sitting. We are facing our final opportunity to ensure that the many services nature provides us do not get irretrievably sabotaged. And yet, amongst all this loss, we are still finding so-called Lazarus species. Species that, unlike Conan Doyle, reappear after we thought them lost. And across the globe, we hear of people who catch the briefest glimpses of animals that are accepted as extinct, but for which concrete evidence of their existence still eludes us. It's clear that we find it hard to let go. We ache for natural loss not to be final. And I want to find out why. I'm Colin Williams.
And I'm Ian Rowlands.
And this is Beneath the Stream, a podcast about the human experience in the non-human world. Maybe we should start by exploring those animals for which a consensus of opinion that they are actually extinct exists, but which many still hold a belief that they're not quite gone. I've got a few examples here. The Yangtze River dolphin, or Baiji. At least one was seen in 2007, it is said, at least a year after it was declared extinct. The passenger pigeon, the very famous passenger pigeon, and the famous Martha, died in Cincinnati Zoo in 1914, long after her kind had disappeared from the wild. But President Roosevelt claimed to have seen a small flock of the birds in 1907, and many people in urban areas have claimed to see birds that look very, very like the passenger pigeon. The Honshu wolf on the island of Honshu in Japan, extinct by 1905. People still claim to see them quite a bit. More impressively, people still hear their yips and yowls from time to time. The Mexican grizzly bear. The last known Mexican grizzly bear was hunted down and killed by poachers in 1960. Despite the official declaration of extinction, multiple people have claimed to have seen these animals. More interestingly, it looks like these bears may have actually gotten to Arizona, where they still exist in small groups, but that's completely unconfirmed. And perhaps most famously of all, the thylacine, or the Tasmanian tiger. Few other extinct species command such a power over our imagination. The possibilities that it might still live have elicited thousands of sightings. Thylacine populations began declining soon after European settlers arrived on Tasmania, winnowed away by government-encouraged hunting, competition from wild dogs, habitat loss and disease. The last known individual, Benjamin, died in captivity in 1936, leaving behind only haunting bits of film footage of Benjamin in his enclosure. There were reported sightings in the decades that followed, which lured multiple expeditions in Tasmania's wilderness to search for survivors. None were successful. Yet reported sightings continued and even increased in the 1980s, and are still reported today.
Yeah, I think I've read somewhere that in 2005, two German tourists claimed to have taken a picture of a live Tasmanian tiger. And a bunch of investigators in 2017, I think in 2018, in fact, a Sydney man had home surveillance footage of a creature he thought was one. And there's a desire to believe, isn't there? And I'm convinced I want to believe.
And I also want to explore whether there's anything in our culture, the way we see and think about the natural world, that has some bearing on these sightings. What do you think it is about the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, that creates this excitement around its possible existence, almost like no other?
Well, from what I've seen, they're remarkable looking creatures. Yes, it's to call it the Tasmanian tiger might conjure in people's minds a vision of a mighty, ferocious beast, which by all accounts it wasn't. I was going to say wasn't, but isn't, if it still exists. You know, it's a sort of marsupial predator, like a small cat or dog with stripes along it and a sharp pointed tail. But it's a remarkable animal, you know, with jaws that can open up to 80 degrees wide. So it's, and I love the indigenous names for the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, the Tasmanian wolf, the European names that we've given it. Corina is one of the Australian Aboriginal names for them, Kanuna or Launa, and there are many variants on that depending on which tribal society you belong to. I guess what I'm getting at here is that those apex predators fascinate us way more than the little mice or weasley things that we don't seem to care so much about. And, you know, nobody's anxious about the sort of Tasman starling that disappeared in 1923 or the Tasmanian emu in 1850. It since has less glamour attached than those apex creatures. So we're fascinated to think that the big predators are still out there.
And I think that's a really key aspect of how we respond to the threat of loss. It's the idea that actually in conservation terms, they talk about charismatic species. It's easy to raise money for saving the whales or any of those things because they're considered charismatic, and trying to raise funds or increase awareness about, as you say, smaller animals, animals that we perceive as being less important mm-hmm. to our habitat and our ecologies, although they are equally as important, so much harder to raise awareness of those things, so much harder for us to elicit a response to when they're things that don't quite fire our imagination in the same way.
Yeah, and I guess part of me thinks we're looking to identify with creatures we think are most like ourselves in some way.
But not all reports of supposedly extinct creatures that have been seen or discovered are unfounded. We live in a world where so-called Lazarus species are still coming to light. And I think there's so many wonderful examples of these Lazarus species. One that captured my imagination as a child was the rediscovery of the coelacanth, the prehistoric primitive-looking fish that was rediscovered in the Indian Ocean, in the oceans around Africa. The New Zealand storm petrel, the mahogany glider in Australia, all these things were declared extinct. And yet, often not through any particular effort, but through serendipity, through luck, through chance, we stumbled across them again. We found that they were still there, often clinging on these tiny relict populations, but they were still there. I find this idea of Lazarus species remarkable. Is there any other Lazarus species that come to your mind?
I want to throw out a few just because I kind of like the stories that go with them, really. And of course, they're not big charismatic species, so perhaps they drift past us unannounced. The mountain pygmy possum, which was thought was only found in the fossil record, never seen alive, but it was found at a ski lodge in 1966. I kind of love the idea of a possum at ski lodge. The Adelaide pygmy blue-tongued skink, which was thought to be extinct, but was found alive in a snake's belly in 1992. The bridled nail-tailed wallaby, which in 1973 was refound because a guy mending fences heard that they were declared extinct and knew where some were and took people to see them. But my favourite of all, really, and I guess I won't do justice with the accent here, but it's the night parrot in Australia, which was refound in 2013. And I love the quote from Sean Dooley, the editor of the BirdLife Journal. He said, it's the bird watching equivalent of finding Elvis flipping burgers in an outback roadhouse. So these things can be refound. And there's a joy and a delight, as you've alluded to previously, in the notion that they're there, the refinding of them, or the placing in our heart of the thought that somewhere out there, they're still there.
And I'm fascinated about what we can learn about ourselves from the rediscovery of these species. I mean, there's some obvious learning points for how we see the world. Actually, it's almost a never give up message that something might still be there, that it might still be there clinging on somewhere. And the story of how we react to these rediscoveries, I think, is best summed up in the story, again, a really well-known example, is best summed up in the story of the rediscovery, or possible rediscovery, of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And it's perhaps one of the strangest stories that has happened relatively recently within our memories. Perhaps you can help set the scene, because I've never been to the hardwood bottomlands of the southern United States and Arkansas and that area. Perhaps you could set the scene for us. What type of landscape and habitat is that?
It's kind of glorious and impenetrable. And I guess that's at the heart of the story, isn't it? Is that it's only with an amount of dedication can you get into it. So it's flooded forest. It's basically water. And you step into a canoe or a boat to go exploring it. And you got to make sure there's no cottonmouth snakes in the boat already. Or they could swim in and get into the boat. So it's going to put people off going there already. But these towering bald cypress trees, festooned with lichens dripping down, the heat, the humidity, the mosquitoes, and then paddling deep into the forest is where you're going to find these things.
And so habitat destruction and hunting have reduced the populations, or had reduced the populations, of ivory-billed woodpecker, that the species is listed critically endangered on the IUCN Red List and as definitely or probably extinct by the American Birding Association. The last universally accepted sighting of an American ivory-billed woodpecker occurred in Louisiana in 1944. And then in 2005, some footage emerged, taken, I believe, from a canoe in the Arkansas swampland. The footage lasts 4 seconds. 4 seconds of grainy footage of a large woodpecker flying away from the camera. But that 4 seconds of footage sparked an enormous worldwide reaction. And on Friday, April 29th, 2005, the second coming of the bird was announced on the front page of the New York Times. Deep in the swamp, the journalist wrote, an extinct woodpecker lives. The ivory-billed woodpecker has been sighted in the Cypress and Tupelo Swamp of the Cache River National Wildlife Refuge in Arkansas. Brinkley, Arkansas, experienced a sudden boost in visitors and local economy. And I remember having listened to this announcement and seen this grainy footage, that just a few weeks later I was visiting a bird reserve in the UK. And the guy working at the kind of reception centre there at this bird reserve had an ivory-billed woodpecker t-shirt on. And that was just a few weeks after, in, you know, a whole other part of the world, the ivory-billed woodpecker had supposedly been rediscovered, that had spread across the world like wildfire. And I think it was more than just, for me, it seemed like more than just big news amongst the birding community. It was a whole story of the possibility that so-called extinction is not final, and was a real example of how we respond to these things when they happen. What's your memories of that and the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Yeah, similarly, friends of mine working for the American Birding Association went to the area to look for the bird too after the reported sighting. They tell me the hotel had been renamed the Ivory Bill Inn overnight, with a banner put over the old hotel sign. There were buttons and t-shirts for sale. But it was, I'm going to use a phrase here, hope and redemption, I suppose. It's like, you know, there's that hope that things still exist, and a sense of redemption that whatever we've done potentially could still be undone. And I guess, you know, we saw that with the joy that greeted the rediscovery of something we thought we'd lost. We see it inadequately in the harvesting of genes and the notion that we can bring these things back to life through cloning and harvesting genetic material. We're kind of trying to find a way for science to fight us out of the bag we've got ourselves into.
And just to bring that story full circle, it then wasn't long before doubt started to be shared about the footage, whether it was an ivory-billed woodpecker, whether it was footage of a very similar looking species. Is it the pileated woodpecker?
Yeah, so and for those listening, this is a woodpecker the size of a crow with dramatic black and white and red plumage and fast flying through the forest, and two very similar species, the pileated woodpecker and the ivory-billed woodpecker.
And I think it's an amazing story. I think it's a great story of the discovery. And as you say, you've given us some stories of some of those Lazarus species that actually, you know, the story of the discovery is often more exciting than the species itself in some people's eyes. But it's a really interesting story about how we respond when this little chink of light appears that we might not have completely destroyed or exterminated these remarkable looking animals.
I think it's really interesting to contrast the celebrations that accompany those glimpses of hope a species has come back, it might still be there, with the complete lack of ceremony sometimes when the last one of its kind goes. So the last thylacine in captivity died, and I think people assumed they could, from Beaumaris Zoological Gardens in Hobart, they could just go and get another one. Mm. So it was unaccompanied by a wailing and a gnashing of teeth and a sense of remorse. And maybe there's some sense that we as a species, as humans, have learned something overdue, and that we can celebrate what we can get back.
As we talk about this commemoration, something that surprises me almost as much as the human capacity to let these things slip, to let these things go and let them die in front of us, is the human capacity for commemoration and all the many, many ways that we commemorate. What are your reflections on that? And are there any examples of that that have stayed with you?
It's interesting, the things that we've heard and the things that we've seen, still I find myself drawn back to, why does it matter? Why do we need to commemorate it? We're such transient beings. And in geological time, what's the great metaphor? They say if you stretched your arms out wide, fingertip to fingertip, and imagine that as the lifespan of the planet, and with the rub of a single nail file, that's the length of time gone would be humans on this planet. So do we need to commemorate whatever's on this planet, been on this planet, gone from this planet? Do we commemorate the dinosaurs? We do because they entertain us, but we don't. Do we mourn them? It seems strange to me that that's an important thing. But I do have my own example, and which didn't touch me either, so maybe that's what I'm reflecting upon. I lived in the Highlands of Scotland for a number of years and went to Loth, a village in Sutherland in northeast Scotland, where a small stone in a car park commemorates allegedly the last wolf killed in Scotland, dated at 1700. And what makes the story even less impactful, I suppose, or that commemoration less impactful, is that there's no evidence that the hunter that stone commemorates was the last wolf. Some people claim the last wolf was killed in 1743 in a beautiful village, vale called Killiecrankie. And others claim that the last wolf was 1688 or 1650. Nobody really knows. And what I found myself looking at this unremarkable, slightly concrete looking stone was what an inept commemoration it was for a powerful life force missing from the land. And so I found myself thinking, this is an irrelevance, this commemoration. It means nothing to me. It means nothing to the wolf that's gone. The greatest thing we could do would be to restore the wolves to the landscape.
Commemoration in writing is another thing that has struck me as an important way of commemorating things. One of the most stirring bits of writing about natural loss that I've ever read is in Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac. And in his chapter in there called Escadilla, He talks about the killing of the last grizzly bear in Arizona's White Mountains. And he said he describes the bear as the outstanding achievement of the pageant of evolution. And Leopold tells of the tragic tale of how old Bigfoot, the last grizzly in Arizona, was killed on Escadilla. The government trapper who took the grizzly knew he had made Escadilla safe for cows. He did not know he had toppled the spire off an edifice of buildings since the morning stars sang together. Escadilla still hangs on the horizon, but when you see it, you no longer think of bears. It's only a mountain now. And I am struck by this idea that commemoration is as much about identifying the space left behind by something lost as it is about a celebration or a mournful memory of the thing itself, whether that is a species, a language, a culture. To understand the gap it leaves, the void it leaves, is an important part of commemorating natural loss. One of the ways that we commemorate natural loss is through the visual arts. So, fine art or sculpture. Have you ever seen a painting, a drawing, something that is no longer with us, that has really affected you?
I think that does affect me, and I have seen paintings by a good friend of mine, an artist, Darren Rees.
Well, Ghosts Have Gone Birds was the brainchild of the filmmaker Kerry Levy, and he, in his own words, he wanted to build a creative army which was breathing life into birds that we've lost, so that we don't lose them anymore. He was really looking at the list that was published by BirdLife International with the list of birds that we've lost since the 1500s, and it was, I think it was about 120, 130 then. I actually checked, and most recently, it's 159 species now that we've lost, gone forever. So he gave us all the list of birds, and to my delight, when I was asked, nobody had taken Carolina parakeet, and I had a particular link with Carolina parakeet for a number of reasons, actually. With this fusion of my own experiences of parrots and parakeets, this image of Audubon's extinct Carolina parakeets in my head, I managed to sort of dovetail the two. It was a real thrill, actually. In fact, I called it, the title of it was Lost Glory, because it must have been a glorious scene to see these masses of colourful, and everybody gets a buzz out of parakeets, even if it's ringneck parakeets in Richmond Park. It's a touch of the exotic, isn't it? And to have these flying around the forests of North America must have been wonderful. Certainly, when you think of the list of extinct species of birds, we rely a lot on actually what artists have contributed in the past, because many of them were never photographed. Yeah, so I went to the Galapagos for the first time in 1992. There was this rather sad figure of Lonesome George, the sole survivor from the giant tortoises on Pinta Island. Of course, I subsequently went back and Lonesome George was there, but sadly in 2012 he died, and that was it, just over 100 years old. But even when I was sketching it, I thought, well, I'm actually sketching something that's functionally extinct anyway. So I can't claim that it's an important drawing, but nevertheless, it is my own experience of actually drawing something that is now extinct. Similarly, on the same trip, I remember sketching vermilion flycatchers on Santa Cruz Island, but on San Cristobal Island, the same vermilion, the different subspecies of vermilion flycatcher has now been ratified as extinct. So it's happening in our own time, and I think that's an alarming thing to think that we're witnessing it as we speak. You know, things are dying. It's very sad.
And here it is. We're here in front of a skeleton of a thylacine, a Tasmanian tiger, and also the stuffed skin of a specimen, Tasmanian tiger, here at the Natural History Museum at Tring. How do you feel now in being in front of this, Ian?
Actually, I was expecting not to be moved at all. I think when I think about coming to museums and skins and specimens, it leaves me feeling a bit cold. But this actually has an amazing amount of life to it. The way it stood before us, its legs are sort of sprung. Its fur looks like tactile. You want to touch it and brush it. And the tiger stripe barring along its back, it feels very real to me.
And there's a very, as you'd expect in a museum, there's a little card in front of it. The thylacine, Thylacinus cynocephalus, Tasmania. And then that one word underneath that, extinct.
I find myself thinking, this is like an emblem, isn't it? This is one representative of an entire species that we've driven to extinction. It's gone, so we believe, and it's very poignant. I'm almost expecting it to speak with some sort of reproach or some sort of message or some sort of notion of what we need to learn from what we've done to this species.
And that was exactly what was crossing my mind. I don't know what I want to believe now. Do I want to believe that these things still exist, that those sightings, those tantalising clips, those video clips, those tantalising photographs, do they represent the possibility that those things are still there? And I sometimes think that desperate need, that desperate want for those things to still be there represents almost the worst of our desires. Sometimes if the desperation to see them is some kind of atonement because we didn't care enough in the first place to preserve them or to save them, we experience this intense demand for a personal revelation, a verified sighting of something like this, as strong as a desire to see the face of God, one writer wrote about these extinct animals. And I almost feel that if we did finally discover a small population of thylacine somewhere, that my elation at that might be short-lived. I'd shortly feel that having resurrected the animal somehow, we'd inevitably destroy it all over again. And perhaps more than that, we'd once more have overreached ourselves in our hubris. We would have, not for the first time, pursued that which we should have left in peace. And I suppose looking at it now, the best thing for me, the greatest thing that could happen would be to hope that they are still there, that they are still there, but that we never find them.
There's a very poignant photo of a triumphant hunter with a shot Tasmanian tiger propped up next to him and his dog by his side and a gun, a grin on his face. I can't say that it was from this, but the Tasmania had the Buckland and Spring Bay Tiger and Eagle Extermination Society, who killed thousands of thylacines. They even perpetuated the myth that they were blood-drinking animals and thus justified eradicating them.
It should be left alone, Sam Keane wrote in his essay, The Lord Godbird. Sacred things are best shrouded by silence and solitude. Well, I think it's time to leave the thylacine alone. And may we leave it and its kind alone for many more years to come, I hope.
Let's go.